Good morning, and welcome to the Mount Stuart Conversations. It's lovely to see so many of you here on such a bright, sunny morning. We were hoping that the weather would work in our favour, and then we weren't quite sure what that actually meant. Maybe if the weather was very good, people might like to be out and about in the weather rather than sitting in a marquee. But I'm glad that you're all here, so thank you very much indeed. We're getting the inaugural Mount Stuart Conversations off to a cracking start with a conversation about Lord Castlereagh, and I've got two guests with me who really are perfectly positioned to conduct that conversation and to discuss a man whose impact on this island and across the British Isles and indeed across Europe and further afield is so significant for so many reasons. But he wasn't a man who didn't also make mistakes, and we will discuss that as well. So let me introduce my two guests first of all. Just sitting alongside me, John Bew, the author of this magnificent tome, of course, on Castlereagh, which I'm sure many of you will have seen and indeed read. John teaches history and foreign policy at King's College London, educated, of course, in Cambridge, contributing editor at The New Statesman, and has written five books, including Realpolitik, which is also, I think, on the table, and that acclaimed, thank you very much, Ed, an acclaimed biography of Lord Castlereagh, Castlereagh, Enlightenment, War and Tyranny, and his most recent book, which has received great reviews, is Citizen Clem, a biography of Attlee. And it's very nice for us to have you here and for you to be back home for the weekend.
Very nice to be back home with the unusually pleasant weather the last 2 days.
Well, no, it's like this all the time. Did you not know that? Did your father not tell you that? No? Since you left?
I don't believe it.
It's been wall-to-wall sunshine, John. And sitting alongside John is Ed Young, who is here, not in Northern Ireland for the first time, but at Mount Stuart for the first time. And again, I say to you, it's always like this in Mount Stuart. Ed has a degree in history from Clare College, Cambridge. He worked as a speechwriter for David Cameron and as chief of staff to the Conservative Party chairman. Has written three books. Again, I think we have a selection on the table in front of us in collaboration with Douglas Hurd, including Choose Your Weapons, the British Foreign Secretary, 200 Years of Argument, Success and Failure, and a biography of Disraeli, and is currently head of corporate communications with Tesco. So you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
You two hadn't met before, but no, you've had an opportunity to have a conversation. So it's going to be interesting to see to what extent you share common ground on Castlereagh and what, if any, the little nuances of difference might be. There's so much to talk about Castlereagh. I suppose we're going to talk about that Irish dimension, the British dimension, his involvement with Europe, of course, which is where the diplomacy comes into it, what he got right, what he got wrong, and I think maybe what the lessons are for 21st century diplomacy as well, if there are any lessons from his legacy. And John, as some of you probably will know, many of you will know, made a very successful film biography of Lord Castlereagh a couple of years ago, linking past and present. And that film, The Extraordinary Life of Castlereagh, which was broadcast, I think, 2013, wasn't it? So we're going to use that really as a vehicle to animate our conversation. So we've got some clips for that. And by definition, it's going to be a little bit chronological in the way that we do it. But it'll just be interesting to see that, to set up Castlereagh, and then to get your thoughts. And there's also an opportunity towards the end of proceedings to let you ask some questions as well, if you're keen to do that. So just before we dive into that first clip, initial thoughts from you, John. Why were you so interested in Castlereagh? Why do you think it's appropriate that discussing his achievements, failures, and legacy is appropriate for the beginning of these Mount Stuart conversations?
The very first simple reason why I was interested in Castlereagh is because he's from the same part of the world as me, and also in some ways sort of similar in some aspects of his family background, Anglo-Irish, though not Anglo-Irish in a conventional sense. The second reason I was interested in Castlereagh is because he segues into a whole lot of series of huge debates that really matter in the world today. So I very much had contemporary events in mind when I started looking at Castlereagh. I was thinking about great power politics, foreign affairs, all these things that interested me professionally. And Castlereagh really is the starting point for so much of what we understand today about Congress diplomacy, about great power politics, about the ups and downs of Britain as a global power, and very much was there at the coalface, the most difficult years with the Napoleonic Wars as well. So fascinating character, you know, personal connection to him as well. And finally, I think what quite appealed to me, and perhaps this is part of who I am and where I'm from, is that he's a slightly difficult and diffident character. He's quite hard to crack. I was always slightly suspicious of George Canning, his rival, who had great wit, who was very confident and spoke with a cut-glass English accent. Castlereagh didn't quite have that. He was slightly awkward in the debating chamber, very shy, soulful, a bit hurt. It's quite a tragic story. So that kind of appealed to me as well. He's kind of a fascinating and a deep character as well. Mm.
Ed, do you remember when you first came across Castlereagh and when you realised he was such a complex character?
Yeah, I think what John says is exactly right. That what's fascinating about Castlereagh is that people throughout history kept on talking about him long after he was dead. And in that job of being Foreign Secretary, people kept on looking back at Castlereagh's career. So people read his memos. They had his painting behind their walls. They defined themselves whether they were a Castlereagh follower or a Canning follower. So his impact intellectually on the way we ran our foreign policy was very, very profound. And you see it running through the 19th century and into the 20th century again and again. Kissinger wrote his dissertation about Castlereagh. Fascinating, amazing impact that this man had. Very, very complex career on the way that the world was run in the 20th century and arguably even today. So it's a great man worth remembering.
But what is also so fascinating is that while he was venerated by so many and seen as such an important figure in terms of his achievements, you know, at the time of his death by so many other people, he was reviled.
Yeah.
He had a stinking reputation and he had the misfortune of being criticised and attacked by some of the most eloquent pens in the English language,
people Byron.
Like Byron and Shelley. So some of their rhymes are very rude, and I won't mention them or repeat them here today. But that sort of was ingrained upon public perceptions of Castlereagh. And there's something to be said about Castlereagh in that he used to, in his early career, defend himself about that type of criticism. By the end, he kind of gave up upon it. And I think that was possibly a mistake. He kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, yes, everybody hates me. I'm just going to get on with life. Mm. But I think it wore him down and was on his shoulders till the end of his life.
Okay, let's dive in and see this opening clip, because if you know about Castlereagh, I think this will confirm a lot of your knowledge. If you don't know about Castlereagh, this opening from John's 2013 film sets up, I think, the discussion that we want to have today. So let's take a look at this. John's introductory thoughts in the film on Castlereagh.
Early in the morning of the 10th of August 1822, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Castlereagh, rose from his bed and with a small penknife that he had hidden from his wife, cut his throat. He was just 53 years old. It was a tragic end for an Irishman who had wielded political power like no other before or since. Castlereagh was the dominant politician in Regency Britain. He was the architect of the 1801 Act of Union, which abolished the Irish Parliament and placed Ireland under the control of Westminster. He created the biggest army in British history and was also instrumental in the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte in 1815. Castlereagh was the master diplomat who remade Europe after the Battle of Waterloo, arguably laying down the blueprint for the European Union. And yet, despite his immense political success in Europe, at home Castlereagh was regarded as an enemy of liberty and freedom, and more despised than any politician of his age.
So who was the real Lord Castlereagh, the Ulster Presbyterian outsider who never felt at home among the English elite?
A reactionary tyrant or a misunderstood visionary? Britain's greatest ever foreign secretary or Ireland's biggest traitor? And what drove Castlereagh, the Ulsterman who was so close to becoming British Prime Minister, to cut his own throat on that August morning in 1822?
This is the tragic and blood-soaked story of one man's rise and fall during an era in which politics was a matter of life and death.
I think that sets it up very well. I have to say, it is an annoyingly fine performance on television. But there you go. It's a great programme. I mean, just how, when you look back at that, and I'm sure you haven't seen it since it was broadcast. Yes, I know. You must be very pleased with it.
I was very pleased to fire a pistol and ride in a
we're
horse-drawn cart.
Yeah, it's very good. And you played both parts.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it does. It looks great. And actually, that sets it up really well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, watching the film again, the way it was actually shot, and it was a dark winter month, and my God, it was cold doing it in Mount Stuart and elsewhere. But actually, in some ways, that sort of gloominess is always there across Castlereagh's life. There's the tragedy, there's the people who died in the 1798 rebellion. People forget, you know, 30,000 people died in Ireland, or around about that much. And Castlereagh is right bang in the center of events. Napoleonic Wars, in which he sends troops to the Falkland Islands, also to the Spanish Peninsula as well. This is a tragic time with a lot of death and tragedy and war. So, I mean, I think that sort of gloominess and sadness and tragedy just hangs above the whole thing.
Ed, you've not seen that before. I mean, I think it sets up what we want to discuss very, very well. And what is so fascinating, as John has said, is the fact that his life is so full of contradiction.
That's right. One thing from the film that I think is amazing is that portrait, that amazing Lawrence portrait of Castlereagh, was painted on the day that he found out that Canning, his great rival, had been plotting to have him sacked from government. And the day he wrote to Canning asking for a duel. And the amazing thing is that Lawrence couldn't work out why he looked so gloomy in the sitting. Why is this man standing there and refuses to smile? And it was because what was about to happen was these two men, colleagues in government, were about to go to Putney Heath and shoot each other.
Yeah. This is close to a snapshot as you could
amazing.
Get 200
Absolutely
years
amazing.
Ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk. I want to talk first of all. We're going to come on to the big European issues, and we do have wonderful footage of that remake of the duel, which we'll come to between Castlereagh and Canning. But I want to talk about the Act of Union and his Irishness, first of all. We have a clip which I think deals with some of that, but just set up the notion of his Irishness and his involvement on this island, first of all, before he became, if you like, a British parliamentarian and a European statesman.
As I say, he's Anglo-Irish, but not Anglo-Irish in a conventional sense. So he's married to an English Anglican Protestant, but he has this Presbyterian background, which is always part of his political makeup. So when he arrives in the Dublin Parliament, he has to take the oath of the Parliament. So in a sense, he's distancing himself from his Presbyterian background. But he's regarded by colleagues as the representative of the Ulster Protestant interest. He comes from this radical Presbyterian heritage. His grandfather paid for the gravestone of Francis Hutcheson, the great Scottish Enlightenment philosopher. So he's very much embedded into this, as I say, Scots Irish world. On the flip side, he's married into the English aristocracy. His father remarries again into the English aristocracy as well. So he has all these sorts of contradictions. But one thing I really wanted to stress in the book, both at a literary and a personal and emotional level, Castlereagh absolutely regards himself as Irish. He talks about matters of the heart and the head, and he says he has, in some respects, an English head, but an Irish heart. And that it stays with him right to the end of his life. And it's one reason, really, why the allegation that he's betrayed Ireland, I think, upsets him more than anything else.
Mm. You're nodding, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, because he was more interested with the debate about ideas, I think, right? So he lived in this time where Europe was in revolution. And the ideas were cutting across in so many different ways. And what he experienced, the just general sense of horror that developed in the 1790s everywhere across Europe had a very, very profound impact on him. And he drew from that a basic pessimism, I think, which never left him. But he felt let down. He made a commitment about what would happen to Ireland, which was never carried through. He always thought that Catholic emancipation would be carried through the Act of Union, and he was let down in that. And he was, as John says, very, very disappointed in the way that the government handled that debate. So I think that's right. He always saw himself as doing the best that he could do for the Irish situation as it was at the time.
Okay, let's take a look then at the second clip in John's film, in which he sets up the whole idea of the Act of Union and talks also about Catholic emancipation. So this is our second clip.
And he believed the only way to save Ireland was to abolish the Dublin Parliament and have the country ruled directly from London, to create a union between Britain and Ireland.
In Castlereagh's mind, this was the opposite of colonialism. It was about governing Ireland the same way as England and Scotland and Wales. Indeed, when it came to Irish affairs, he believed the English Parliament was calmer, more liberal, and willing to compromise on a range of issues, such as those of Catholic rights, which he strongly supported.
Alongside the British Prime Minister, William Pitt, he drew up a plan he believed would bring peace to Ireland. Firstly, to pass an Act of Union through which Irish MPs would sit at Westminster rather than Dublin. But key to this was the second part of his plan, to pass an Act of Emancipation that for the first time would allow Catholics to become MPs. Making such momentous changes was not going to be easy.
First, Castlereagh had the difficult task of persuading the Irish Parliament to vote for its own abolition.
But persuasion only got him so far, and Castlereagh was soon relying on suitcases of Secret Service money in order to bribe the opponents of the Union to come on side. Here we have a list of the supporters in black and the opponents in red. And with his own pen, Castlereagh has marked an X by those who might still be persuadable.
The debates over the Union were extremely bitter, and angry crowds gathered outside the gates of the Irish Parliament. One morning in August 1800, as the crucial vote loomed, Castlereagh's carriage pulled up and he stepped outside, and he was hit in the face by a putrid dead cat. He turned to the crowd, he took off his hat, and he bowed. He knew he was close to victory.
Finally, at 10 p.m. on the 7th of June 1800, the Bill of Union passed the Irish House of Commons. Ireland as a nation, cried one disgusted anti-union MP, was extinguished. With the Irish Parliament abolished, on the 1st of January 1801, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland came into being. It did so under a new emblem, the Union flag, which incorporated the cross of St. Patrick. As bells rang out across the city, Castlereagh began to plan his new life in London. He did so with the support of his wife, Emily Hobart, a young English heiress from a powerful Anglican family, whom he had married 7 years earlier. As a couple, they were practically inseparable. And as a shy Ulsterman in London, Castlereagh appreciated Emily's natural vivaciousness and ease in company.
Theirs was a life of high society. Dinners at their home in St. James's Square were lavish affairs attended by the great and the good, generals, diplomats, and aristocrats from across Europe.
Life seemed good, but any sense of triumph Castlereagh might have had about the union between Britain and Ireland was to be short-lived.
He was disappointed that he wasn't able to deliver on everything that he hoped he could deliver on. Since we're talking about diplomacy, what do you think, Ed, first of all, the skills were that he brought to bear to be able to deliver the Act of Union so soon, of course, after the 1798 rebellion?
He was one of the interesting things about Castro. He was a very careful man. Took a very long time over details. That clip that you showed of him putting crosses next to people's names is exactly on him. Someone like Canning would never have done that. They wouldn't have wasted time with that kind of details. They'd have just gone in, given a great speech about it, expected everyone to follow. But he was absolutely painstaking, huge attention to detail. And the debate then is, was he unscrupulous? To what extent did the methods that he applied to persuade all of those parliamentarians to vote for their own assembly to be abolished? How did he do it? Was it bribery? Was it worse? And that's, we never formed a strong view about that. Where did you get to on that?
It was bribery, yeah. And it was worse, but it was done with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. And
isn't it always?
Isn't it always? And there's a revolutionary side to Castlereagh, actually, and people talk about his conservatism, and that's true to a great extent, and he becomes conservative because of what happens with the French Revolution. But there's two qualifications to that, and the first qualification is that he has these Enlightenment ideals. I mean, he has progressive political views on the main civic and religious issues of the day. And the second qualification to this idea that he's a conservative is that actually there's a revolutionary side to Castlereagh, and some people point that out, like Sheridan in the Irish Parliament, the great playwright. He says, this is the real revolution. You're trying to rip up the system and get rid of an Anglo-Irish aristocracy and, you know, replace it with something else, almost, you know, to modernize the system too fast. And that's the objection to him. But absolutely. I mean, actually, I also think when it comes to the Irish Parliament, I mean, yes, Castlereagh bribed it out of existence, but the very fact that it accepted the bribe in some ways is a comment on the system itself.
But it is fascinating that you talk about him as an Enlightenment figure, progressive, politically, revolutionary, and yet he processed all of that information and reached a completely different conclusion to the United Irishmen, who went through the same process, looked at the same evidence, and decided that actually the opposite. You know, the very last thing they wanted was an act of union.
Yeah. I think he has the striking thing is the extent to which Castlereagh shares very similar views to the United Irishmen and the radicals.
But
is that he looks at Europe and he looks at the French Revolution and he says, well, for those values and those rights to really exist, change has to happen more slowly. And that's what Castlereagh gives in Foreign Affairs as well, in Statecraft, which is a view of change that has to preserve and protect things rather than ripping up everything, destroying it at its foundations. Because all you're going to be left with, and this is what he sees in France, is anarchy, sectarianism, atavism, bloodlust, all the things, the type of thing you see in Syria today, for example. When you knock everything over too quickly, you're going to end up in a disaster. And that's his argument. Mm.
John and I both did our undergraduate dissertations on the 1790s, and what you found in that time was that actually the majority of Enlightened opinion was in favor of both the American Revolution and the French Revolution until the French killed the king. And that was the watershed. So 1792, from then on in, there was a shift. And people like Castlereagh and Canning and Pitt moved, and they became absolutely convinced that the key was to stop this wave of revolution, which involved kings being killed, from going any further. And that was the basic question. Where do you draw the line? It was more about that than it was about nationalism. Mm. It was the question of what's the right form of government and where do you draw the line. And so Castlereagh, as a young boy, wrote, you know, I'm a true American, I back the Americans. Equally, in the early stages of the revolution, they were in favor of what was going on until that moment. And Castlereagh went to France, he saw what was happening and was worried at that point. But the crucial thing that changed opinion, majority opinion, in that period was the killing of the French king. That was when it swung.
I want to talk about his relationship with George Canning. And we'll see an extract from the film in just a moment and get John's thoughts on that. But you've written about the relationship between the two of them, Ed. Mm. How would you sum it up? I mean, why was there such a difficulty between the two of them?
Well, it is an amazing character story. So my mother, she went to a convent school in the 60s, and you were asked three questions in that class. You were asked whether you preferred Disraeli or Gladstone. You were asked if you preferred the Cavaliers or the Roundheads. And you were asked if you would back Canning or Castlereagh. And it would be these three iconic questions. And my mother was very proud. She was the only one in the class to back Disraeli. She was the only one in the class to be a Cavalier. And she was the only one to back Canning. And so she was rather furious when I produced this book, basically arguing that Canning was a bit of a nightmare. But Canning was an amazing man, right? And politicians love Canning because the speeches are just amazing. I mean, absolutely incredible. And the phrases he came out with are just golden. But he was the sort of temperamentally the opposite of Castlereagh. Intellectually quite similar in some ways, but temperament was totally different. Castlereagh was always slightly unsure of himself, always quite pessimistic about his own abilities. Canning had no doubts about that. He was the best person who's ever been graced on the land of this country. He was absolutely convinced that he was brilliant. And he carried that through everything he did. And the interesting thing is, in many ways, their backgrounds were very similar. They were both Anglo-Irish, both born in the same year, well, within a year of each other. They both had that period of time where they were in favor of, you know, liberalism, as it was described. But then they moved in different ways. And it was about the method rather than the morals. So Castlereagh very much believed in very careful negotiation, taking a long time to get to the right answer, working with others. Canning thought he should just work with himself because he was the best man for the job. And that was a sort of fundamental difference between the two of them. And that really runs through everything. But Canning also, people consistently throughout history turn back to Canning because they will find a great speech that he gave which had illuminated a truth in it about something. Castlereagh never did that. And it's harder to really pin down what made Castlereagh really great because you would never really find great phrases or great ideas. Canning had that ability, and that's the difference between the two men.
Right. And it led, that tension led to this duel, very dramatic duel, which I think you tell in remarkable fashion. So I'll get your thoughts, but I want people to see this first of all. So let's take the third extract from John's film, where he reenacts the battle between Castlereagh and Canning.
And Canning were like chalk and cheese. Whereas Castlereagh was shy and reserved, Canning was a brilliant speaker, with a tongue so cutting, it was said that it could lash the hind of a rhinoceros. But as one of the most level-headed statesmen of the time, what Castlereagh did next shocked everyone. He turned to an old-fashioned but deadly way of settling his dispute with Canning and challenged him to a duel.
Shortly after 6 a.m. on the 21st of September 1809, the War Secretary and the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain met on Putney Heath with their pistols loaded. They took 10 paces from each other. Turned. Took aim. Both missed their first shot, but Castlereagh was still not satisfied, so they resumed for a second round. This time Canning was shot in the thigh and collapsed in a heap in the grass.
Now onlookers were treated to an extraordinary sight as Castlereagh carried his fellow cabinet member, the man he had just shot, to a nearby house for treatment to his wound.
Gills rather let him down at that point. He resorted in extremis to the gun. But anyway, Is it right that Canning's reported to have said, are we done, as he limped off?
He was picked up. Didn't say much, actually. I'll be honest, when I first heard about the duel in school, I think it was during GCSE history, I think my initial favouritism towards Castlereagh was simply because of the fact he won the duel.
Yes, exactly.
Which I sort of thought was much more impressive. And also, there is something in Castlereagh in sort of picking up Canning and walking off with him, and that was it for both of them. Castlereagh went back to his house in St. James's Square later that day and wrote this most wonderfully emotional letter to his father. And if you think how long it took, it probably about a week to get a letter from London to Mountstuart in those days. And his father knows about the duel because it's announced and he receives the letter. And he's sitting in Tenderhooks, you know, desperately concerned about the fate of his son, and he pours out his heart in a response thereafter. So it was a hugely, it wasn't done sort of willy-nilly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of duels in that period, and Castlereagh's Flashman-esque brother fought about five of them. But he himself was sort of, you know, calm and level-headed, and that's why it was unusual. But what's really striking about it is actually the pair of them got over it after a while, and towards the end of their life, particularly when it came to foreign policy, had a lot of you know, similarities, essentially, and they were on the same page by about 1822 when Castlereagh died. So it was done, it was hugely emotional. It was unusual for Castlereagh to go to your original question, but it was a matter of honour for him, and he felt he was being betrayed.
Yeah, he was lucky, though, because I think Canning took a button off
he
Castlereagh's
did, off the chest,
waistcoat.
Yes.
Yeah. So it could have gone either way.
There was I don't know where your learned conclusion is on this question. The question is, where did the bullet hit Canning? And they use this phrase, the fleshy part of the thigh.
That's right.
Which yeah. I always thought was a euphemism for a higher part of the thigh.
Possibly.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, Canning spoke with a much higher pitched accent.
He did.
So
he did.
That's
he
not
did.
True. That's a... That's
yeah.
A
yeah.
Anyway, they put it behind them. You've lived every boyhood dream there in
no one was harmed by the
reenacting.
Way,
no, I'm glad.
It's worth saying it was at 12 paces,
which
is the longest you can be, right? So you could be closer, but they took the decision that they wanted to be as far apart as they could. So they, although they had to go through it because of the challenge of being issued, they weren't actually trying to kill each other at their most, right? So they'd gone 12 paces, and neither of them were very good shots. Canning had never fired a pistol in his life, so. So it wasn't exactly the most dangerous duel that there's ever been.
Okay, let's take another extract from the film, which I think moves us on to the whole war in Europe and the beginning of this sense of his statesmanship and his role as a senior diplomat, if you like, as foreign secretary. So there's a little extract, clip 4, which sets up the Grand Alliance to defeat Napoleon and Castlereagh's role in that. So let's take a look at that.
State of Europe hanging in the balance, Castlereagh set sail for the continent on New Year's Eve 1813 with one overarching aim, and that was to bring about a grand alliance of all Napoleon's enemies to defeat him finally. It must be one cause and one effort, or it is nothing, he said. That winter was one of the coldest on record, and the roads were so bad that Castlereagh had to abandon his carriage and travel on horseback. British foreign policy was literally being conducted on the hoof. He went first to The Hague, then through Germany, and into Basel, the Swiss city on the border with France, where Europe's leaders were gathering. Castlereagh soon recognised that the greatest obstacle to the Allied war effort was for them to fall out between themselves. Charming, handsome, and dignified, no one beat him in the diplomatic game. As some of Europe's most powerful men gathered around the table, the stakes were high, and they were keeping their cards close to their chests. But Castlereagh was the man playing the best hand, as he took control of the negotiations, determined that their outcome would be a continent united in peace.
in a sense, John, writing the diplomatic manual at this point?
There's lots to be said about Castlereagh's diplomacy in terms of his character and his disposition and his temperament. So he's calm, he's cautious, he's able to build relationships that last, particularly with Count Metternich, the chief Austrian diplomat. And so the style, there's something to be said about Castlereagh's style. I think actually an underappreciated part of the story is the fact that Castlereagh is also, in modern terms, a hawk. So he builds, he's part, as war secretary previously, builds one of the biggest armies in British history. And his diplomacy is following the movement of troops. So Europe's crowned heads and chief diplomats are meeting about 10 miles behind each battle that Napoleon's pushed further back into France. So he's calm, he's distinguished, he builds these relationships, but he also says at the key moment, which is the Treaty of Chaumont, which is the kind of prelude to the Treaty of Vienna, he says, what a display of power, what a display of force. And it's because Wellington's, the Duke of Wellington's troops are coming up through Spain into France. Britannia rules the waves. So you know, Castlereagh, sometimes I think there's a mistake made about Castlereagh that if we just calm down a little bit, if we stop being so grandiloquent with our words, if we just talk quietly, then we can have, you know, more effective diplomacy. I think it fails to appreciate the extent to which Castlereagh is one of the warriors of the war, one of those who says there should be never peace with France until the end. Mm. So it's a kind of a, it's and Churchill really admires this about him, this ability to flip the switch in diplomacy, not to fight the last war. So, you know, the war is against Napoleonic France, but when it comes to the peace treaty and the arrangements, Castlereagh is able to go in an alliance with France, you know, months after the vanquishing of Napoleon, months after the Battle of Waterloo, and to go in alliance against Russia. And at the end of the Second World War, that's what Churchill really admires about Castlereagh, because, you know, after being in league with Russia, the Soviet Union, Churchill suddenly sees it as the enemy, very similarly. He looks back at Castlereagh's diplomacy in 1815, and he goes, that remarkable thing that Castlereagh did, switching, he calls it. So calm, you know, not fighting the last battle, but also an appreciation that diplomacy does not exist in a vacuum.
It's where diplomacy meets politics, isn't it?
It's worth saying he was the first foreign secretary to set foot abroad. So no foreign secretary had ever gone abroad while foreign secretary before that moment when Castlereagh went over in 1814. That's an extraordinary fact. And so this was absolutely unprecedented in that sense. And he thought, because it was so critical to keep that alliance together, right through to the point where France was absolutely defeated, the only way they could do it was if he was there driving around. And the ground he covers in a carriage is absolutely extraordinary. He only spent one night in an inn in the first 2 months. So he slept in his carriage, bombing around France and Switzerland to try and catch up with the Allies. It's an amazing feat, never been done before. And so in that sense, diplomacy had never existed like that until he did it. But John's right, it wasn't just the fact that you're going to be nice to someone and shake their hand and talk to them. Absolutely not. You needed an army, you needed force, and you needed to get... He used this phrase... To keep France in check, you need great masses. And that was absolutely it. You're not going to, this annoying, noisy country that goes around invading other countries, the only way you're going to keep it quiet is if you have power, either side of it, calming it down. And he was absolutely always on that foot, on that point.
And that logically, the story then moves on to the defeat of Napoleon, obviously at Waterloo. And then was it Castlereagh's high point, the Congress of Vienna, is that the point at which he displayed his full powers, do you think?
Absolutely. It's actually the perfect environment for Castlereagh, the Congress of Vienna, for a number of reasons. We've talked about his sort of slow, cautious style. The Congress of Vienna went on forever, months and months and months, to the great anger of radicals in English press who said, you know, look at all the money being spent. The English delegation alone drank 10,000 bottles of wine. I suspect about 9,000 probably drunk by Castlereagh's brother at this period, who managed to get himself arrested and threw a cab driver into the Danube at one point and was sleeping with Austrian Secret Service spies masquerading as prostitutes. He was a bit of a disaster. But Castlereagh was the exact opposite. And over the course of that sort of slow period, when he was sort of keeping his brother in check, he built these relationships. He pivoted back towards France, because he started to become concerned about the Tsar. He played a straight bat and classic Englishisms. The English like to talk about diplomacy with cricketing analogies, but actually it does apply here. Everyone else was playing sort of backstairs intrigue, but everyone knew where Britain stood and Britain's position was. And, you know, he wasn't really giving up that much. You know, don't touch navigation of the seas. We'll keep our colonies. But the other thing that he does, and I think this is absolutely crucial for his diplomacy, and I don't think he'd struggle in today's diplomatic atmosphere, where you have to give a press conference, where the content of your meeting is known before it even takes place, where there's tweets all the time. Cassero is about a month away from, in terms of a letter, from a telling off by his own cabinet. And my God, they told him off. The Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, says, come home by Christmas. We need you to steer tax reform through Parliament. Enough of this. Give up on Poland. Why are you fiddling with Poland? Why are you standing up against the Tsar? Give it up. Come home. But Castlereagh says, no, no, no. And he goes renegade. He resists the control of his Prime Minister and his Parliament. So that is where his sort of true genius and foresight comes out. And when he comes home for the first and the only time in his life, one of those unusual parliamentary moments, he's given a round of applause across the way. And even former enemies stand up and go, okay, I respect what you've done here. You know, what an achievement. But to achieve that, he needs to be isolated from everyone, closed diplomacy rather than open diplomacy.
There's an amazing letter that the Prime Minister sent Castlereagh. It would be very helpful to see your treaty before it's finally agreed, brackets, to guard against minor errors. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't imagine, you know, Tony Blair writing this to Jack Straw. It's an absolutely extraordinary division of labour. Are we allowed a word about Lady Castlereagh at Vienna? Sure. So Lady Castlereagh, an amazing character, and he, as you say in the film, John, he was really in love with her. I mean, genuinely in love with her, and they were very unusual by the standards of the time in that they objected to doing things on Sundays. They were absolutely not a Regency-style couple. They didn't like the low moral standards of European high society. They didn't like that. But she was slightly dotty, and she caused a moment of extraordinary confusion. Castlereagh had been given the Order of the Garter for his successes as Foreign Secretary. Lady Castlereagh decided it would be a good idea to wear the Order of the Garter as a decoration in her hair to the ball at the Vienna Congress. And this really sort of set the mood for this lady who's slightly odd. So but it was a tricky time for him.
Between his wife and his brother, he was constantly given these headaches.
Amazing.
And there's another great quote from Lady Castlereagh when she's walking around Vienna. She says, the shops, my God, we almost broke our necks looking. So she really she spent a lot of money.
It's a very good point that. The Austrian spies wrote police reports because they couldn't understand why the Castlereaghs went to shops but didn't buy. They'd never seen this British concept of browsing before. So you see these bizarre, it's true, isn't it?
Bizarre
police reports. What are they doing here? Why didn't she buy the hat? Anyway.
Let's see your take on the Congress of Vienna from the film. This is our fifth clip.
The pinnacle of Castlereagh's career and his most lasting achievement came just 6 months after the triumphant procession into Paris, when he travelled to Vienna to take part in a congress that would change Europe forever.
And here we are. These are the very chairs from the Congress of Vienna which Castlereagh had brought back to Mount Stuart, chairs on which the most powerful men of Europe sat together, knocked their heads together, and redrew the map of the continent.
But it wasn't all business. The top-level political negotiations took place against a backdrop of ostentatious banquets and concerts. In a matter of months, the British delegation alone got through 10,000 bottles of wine.
For all the pomp and the partying at Vienna, the Congress changed forever the way that nations did business with each other. Castlereagh was instrumental in creating a new form of diplomacy, whereby the great powers could meet in concert to settle their differences without having to fight a war.
As time would tell, the system was not perfect. But its emphasis on a diplomatic approach to conflict was pioneering. And without it, it's difficult to imagine today's European Union.
Which is fascinating. Did he effectively play a major part in building the scaffolding for modern Europe?
I've actually changed my mind since I said that, and Brexit is one of the reasons why. Actually, I think you look at what he did at the Congress of Vienna, it's more the forerunner to the UN, or perhaps even more accurately, NATO, a sort of defensive alliance based on an understanding of great power politics. Mm. Now, Castlereagh is most enthusiastic because this was an achievement. Let's not underestimate what he did. The great powers met in regular congresses. They sat and agreed to cooperate. They would, you know, expressed a deep faith in diplomacy after more than two decades of war. So I don't want to belittle the achievement. And Castlereagh is most excited, says, we have reduced the affairs of Europe to the simplicity of a single state. So there's your kind of, you know, your EU vision there. But actually very soon he becomes disillusioned with it, or not disillusioned with it, worried about it. And what worries him is that the other European nations regard this project as something different than the British. And actually you can see the classic difficulties and tensions between the British view of what's going on here and what everyone else you know, regards it as.
And that kept going for 200 years.
That kept going for 200 years. So I've often asked the question more recently, you know, would Castlereagh supported Brexit or remain in the EU? And I basically, what I really think instinctively is because of his conservative, cautious mindset, he would have actually, you know, advocated a remain vote, and he believes we should cooperate, you know, with our European partners. However, there's a caveat to that, and it's this. I think Castlereagh would be alarmed and basically object to the concept of federalism and bringing Europe sort of ever closer together. And he saw the limitations, and he saw the limitations particularly in British public opinion, and left or right, and he saw that people at home thought, you know what, this is a little bit too much, and the Tsar would push it too far, and the Austrians would push it too far. The idea that you could have one sort of governing aristocracy who could keep Europe going. And Castlereagh evoked John Bull, the caricature of the, you know, beer-drinking Englishman, and he said, my allies must not push me to ground, which John Bull will never support. John Bull will not take it if they make me become too federalist, if they make me become, you know, too associated with Europe. So he understood that core thing. There's a limit to British support for Europe.
It's an interesting parlor game. Where would he have stood on Brexit? And also, did he establish, as John is saying, you know, was it the European Union? Was it NATO? Was it the UN?
So I think there are two things, right? I think what he did at Vienna was he invented collective security. So previously, you'd never had a peacetime agreement whereby all the signatories would agree that if any of them were attacked, they'd all come and defend. That had never happened before. That was absolutely new. And that was the basis of the Vienna settlement. And it wasn't even his idea, it was Pitt's idea. So he stole it, but he made it work. And that was genuinely revolutionary. And that's why it's closer really to NATO than anything else, what he did there. But he also did start this pattern of European consultation. And he wrote these letters talking about, we've created something which is, as John says, is a new invention. It's a regular format for discussing things of collective interest. And this was the moment where Canning came back on and started complaining. And he wrote, again, these are letters and gave speeches that could have been given today. When I hear Europe, I would rather hear England. And it was exactly, this is the same debate started over. To what extent is it really useful to go to Europe and talk about matters that are of general interest? Why do we really need to? And Canning didn't think we needed to. Castlereagh thought it was helpful. And that was the debate. But the fundamental thing he invented in 1815 was collective security. That was the absolutely game-changing thing. And it's why that settlement lasted 100 years, in effect. It was the first time you'd ever had a period of peace between the great powers of Europe for such a long period of time.
John, do you think he identified as a European? Was there such a thing as European identity? You know the John, this is something I have a particular interest in, but you know John Hewitt's notion of identity, and Castlereagh would have fitted into this, you know, an Ulsterman, an Irishman, British and European. Did he tick all of those boxes, or was the concept of European identity something that came along a lot later?
No, I think he did identify as a European, but there's a problem inherent in that. So as a young man, he did the Grand Tour, was available to wealthy young men, in which he went to see the ruins of ancient Rome. He travelled through France and Italy, and you know, across Europe. So he was familiar with these areas. He could talk, not very well, incidentally, in French, but he could talk in French, the language of diplomacy. He was at home with European aristocrats, but that was the issue for most Britons, because there was a European identity, but those who held that identity were regarded as aloof, self-interested, something a little bit apart from the average Briton, and that's really the issue. So he held and understood that, but that, there's a real limit to that. And you look at the English press, as I say, across the left and the right, they just don't like this. They don't like Britons swanning around with aristocrats with great plumes out of their hat. It's just kind of not the British way, and that sort of attitude comes out very strongly in the press at the moment in time. So absolutely European identity, but you see the problem with the European identity.
Mm. Is there? I think we'll come on to his legacy at the end, but just at this point, before we talk about his downfall, his collapse, his descent into arguably madness, are there lessons today for the diplomats of the 21st century in examining how he and others around the table handled Vienna?
Absolutely. I think Edward had a bang on when he talked about collective security. But something interesting happens, and also Edward said at the start, as you develop over history, Castlereagh's reputation waxes and wanes. And at the end of the First World War, the peacemakers of Vienna are regarded like mud. So the narrative at the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War is that these guys got it wrong. They tried to put nationalism and liberalism in a box and squeeze it down and exploded. And look what happened. And this is the First World War. And over the course of the 20th century, that view is revived. So we're another 100 years on. And actually, it's the Treaty of Vienna and the peacemakers of Vienna who are regarded as more wise and thoughtful and having more foresight. So I think we're in an odd period of history again, in which things are troubling. We need cautious language. We need to think long term. We need to find out who our allies are. We need to think seriously about security. In which Castlereagh comes back into fashion very, very sharply.
Mm. It's an odd cycle when you start looking at it. It seems to be every 100 years or thereabouts we find ourselves in this situation.
The only thing I'd also say, right, is that foreign policy, as Castlereagh ran it, was about character. So you form a judgment about the person who is running the country you're dealing with based on your interactions with them. And until you have a pattern of interactions, you can't form a judgment about whether you trust them or not. And Castlereagh spent time with Metternich, and he liked him, and he trusted him. He didn't necessarily agree with everything he said, but he trusted him. And I think that's the fundamental difference. So the great age of diplomacy that came after Castlereagh was partly because if you spend time and you actually really scrutinize your interlocutor's character, you form a view about whether can be taken at their word. And he formed the view, rightly, that the Tsar was mad, but he also thought the view that Metternich was actually, on the whole, to be trusted or to be worked with, could be worked with. And I think that's the new innovation for spending time in that kind of diplomacy.
Okay. I'm mindful of the fact that some of our audience may have questions. We have a couple of very short clips, and we're coming towards the landing point at this stage. Let's talk about his collapse. Let's just look at what you said in the film, first of all, and then see if we can put together the pieces of the jigsaw to explain why he did what he did at the age of, 53. So here's that relevant portion from the film.
To escape the vicious criticism, Castlereagh would always return to the family home at Mount Stuart in County Down, in particular to the Temple of the Winds, a resting place and lookout point built by his grandfather many years before.
Having lost his mother as an infant, Castlereagh was much more sensitive and vulnerable than his cool public persona suggested. And while he could cope with abuse from strangers, nothing hit him so hard as the death of his father, Lord Londonderry, in April 1821.
Castlereagh was grief-stricken. He had been intensely close to his father. But he had also lost the man he relied on for support during the ups and downs of his political career. And he lost him at a particularly decisive moment. Even Castlereagh's critics were surprised by how weary he looked in the House of Commons. And his calm demeanour seemed to be replaced by a growing paranoia and incoherence. By the end of July 1822, his friends began to fear that he was losing his mind.
On Friday the 9th of August, Castlereagh was seen looking fraught and agitated as he made his way to see George IV. "Have you heard the news, the terrible news?" he asked the king. "Police officers are searching for me to arrest me."
When the king demanded an explanation, Castlereagh said that he feared exposure for a homosexual act. "I am mad," he told the king amid sobs. "I know I am mad. I have known it for some time." The foreign secretary was unravelling before the king's eyes.
There's been speculation that Castlereagh was the victim of a plot, that he'd had an encounter with a prostitute who turned out to be a transvestite, and that he was now being blackmailed. But the weight of evidence suggests that he was suffering from a mental breakdown, perhaps paranoid schizophrenia, brought about by a combination of grief and stress.
Certainly the Duke of Wellington was deeply worried for his old friend, saying, "I entertain no doubt he is very unwell."
Right. Now, we have a conundrum, don't we, as to quite... I mean, nobody knows for sure precisely what happened and why what happened happened. What just looking at how John tried to pick his way through that, what do you make of it?
Well, there are three theories, aren't there? Theory one, he was just absolutely overwhelmed. He'd been Foreign Secretary for 10 years, completely exhausted, worn down, and had a, in effect, a collapse, a mental collapse. That's theory one. Theory two is that he'd had... this extraordinary encounter where in 1819, on his way home from Parliament, he was walking through St. James's, he met a prostitute, went to the house, and the prostitute undressed, turned out to be a man, and then all these people jumped out of the behind the sofa and said, "You've been exposed as a sodomite." So he thought he was then being blackmailed for this. That was theory two. And theory three, there's a medical theory. I don't know if you went into this. There's a doctor, in Giles Hunt is his name,
yep,
who went back to Cambridge, where Castlereagh had been a student, and found that he'd contracted syphilis as a young man, a very young man, an undergraduate. And syphilis can have lots of impacts, but it can affect your brain. And it's possible that it had actually just effectively eroded his nervous system. So those are the three theories. I think there is no doubt he was exhausted, but I think it is likely that something along the lines of what you have in the film did happen. I think he probably did have some experience. He probably was blackmailed. He talked about the Bishop of Clogher, who was an Irish bishop and had been caught in a pub with a soldier engaged in acts that were then at the time illegal. And he was effectively blackmailed until it was revealed. And Castlereagh was obsessed that the same thing was going to happen to him. So it's very hard to say. They bled him. They bled him. He saw the king, and the king said, you need to go and get help straight away. And they bled him, and the stuff that came out of his veins was meant to have been a bit like jelly, which did indicate that there was something physiologically wrong as well. But it's very hard to form a solid judgment.
So obviously when I started researching it, that was probably the key thing in the back of my mind, and I went through all the gutter press, the various theories. He definitely contracted something like syphilis when he's a young man in Cambridge, very embarrassingly for him. He talked to his uncle about a condition he could not mention in front of the ladies, and it's one reason why his university career was cut short. There is this sort of scandal around the story of the Bishop of Clogher. The great amusing thing about the Bishop of Clogher is that actually he was about to get away after his encounter with the Grenadier Guardsman, but his breeches were around his ankles, so he fell over and was caught thereafter. But the chronology doesn't actually make sense to me, which suggests it was actually a mental breakdown, because the Duke of Wellington was being blackmailed simultaneously, and Castlereagh, as his mind starts to leave him, really, or his brain cells are obviously in real trouble, he conflates all these different stories. So
right.
He talks as if he's being blackmailed, and yet the Duke of Wellington says, no, I'm being blackmailed. I'm pretty fine with it. Duke of Wellington doesn't really matter. He's blackmailed every week. But Castlereagh starts repeating the Duke of Wellington's story, so there's an incoherence to him, which makes it suggest to me right. that it is very much a sort of a mental breakdown.
Mm. I mean, it was a very sad. He was a young man, relatively speaking, certainly, well, by our standards, a young man at 53.
Yeah.
And it was. Well, I was going to say an unimpressive end, but I suppose. Well,
yeah,
I don't know how you would characterize it.
I think it's deeply tragic, but particularly because of what happened afterwards. The funeral was in Westminster Abbey, and the mob were braying with satisfaction outside. This is a man who's in effectively rescued Europe, and that's the treatment he gets. People wrote, you know, Byron wrote a poem. He's cut his neck at last. He has the man who cut his throat of his country years ago. Absolutely horrendous for a man who, you know, given his life to public service. I think it's deeply tragic. I also, though, think he had run out of steam. And when you look at those last years, he'd really lost his way. He couldn't work out what to do with Greece, and his system of diplomacy wasn't working. And so I don't think it was that there was a great career that didn't happen. I don't think that's the case. I just think it was a completely unfitting end for what was a remarkable man.
Mm. John?
The only thing I'd say to that, and I agree his brain was not as sharp, and intellectually he'd run out of steam, is that everyone else around him had either passed away or run out of steam first. And actually, he'd managed to outlast most of them. So he was odds on. If you had a bookies at the time, they would have said Castlereagh is odds on to be the next prime minister. And his reputation had recovered some of the early criticism. You know, people were sort of rallying around him. Canning again was essentially an exile, his sort of chief rival at that moment. So the irony is he'd reached the point in which he might become prime minister. There have been conversations about that. Lord Liverpool, the prime minister, nearly resigned and then decided not to. So you know, he had actually, you know, hit the pinnacle. One of his friends described him as sitting there at a dinner party shortly before he lost his mind as Mont Blanc. So he had sort of, you know, snowy hair, but he looked sophisticated, supreme, on top of his game. But actually, I think your point is fundamentally right. His sort of mental wherewithal had been slightly eroded.
We've covered so much ground, and it's remarkable that we've covered so much in such a relatively short period of time, given the scale of what he achieved and the impact that he had on so many parts of history at that time. But I do want to give people an opportunity just to ask a quick question or two. We've got 5, maybe 10 minutes, the absolute most, if we want to take it. So we've got some microphones. If anybody wants to ask a quick question, there's a gentleman with a... We've got guys with microphones, we do. Could we get a microphone up to a gentleman just in the front row, please? If you want to identify yourself, please do. And if you just, any questions, if you could just keep them relatively succinct, then we'll get as many people in as we can. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Richard Moore. I can ask two little issues. The first one relates to the Act of Union. One of the groups who weren't opposed to the Act of Union was the Catholic hierarchy. In fact, as I understand it, the Catholic Church were actually quite sanguine about the Act of Union. What then characterises those Dublin parliamentarians who were most opposed to it? You know, what characterises them, and what were their motives for the opposition? The second question I just want to ask, and that is that after the defeat of Napoleon, Castlereagh seems to have been opposed to the imposition of heavy war penalties on France. And that contrasts so sharply with what happened to Germany after the First World War. The heavy war penalties ultimately led to Hitler and disaster in the Second World War. He seems to have had the foresight to realise that heavy war penalties wasn't a good idea, and that could have jeopardised the peace later on. So just those two points.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, great question. Actually, I mean, that's why Catholic emancipation being attached to the Union is one of the great, A, missed opportunities, and B, what-ifs of Irish history. Because there was, Castlereagh had worked extremely hard to get the Catholic hierarchy to support what they expected to be a Union plus emancipation. In terms of those opposed to it, there's actually quite an interesting sort of a coalition of people. The main opponents would be those old landed aristocracy who had run the old Dublin Parliament, in their interest essentially, who had a sense of the nation as well. I don't want to talk them down and demean them entirely. That would be sort of class one. And they regard Castlereagh as an interloper, really. And the second would be those who are increasingly associated with the nascent Orange movement. You know, one of the great ironies of 1801 is, you know, significant chunks, half, I would guess, around about half, if not a majority, of those involved or those aristocratic patrons of the Orange Order did not want the Union because they saw it as something that was defiantly not Orange. So, again, one of these great ironies of history. Second thing, yeah, you're absolutely right on the war reparations. And there's a lot of historians at the time of the Treaty of Versailles who write about how the peacemakers, Woodrow Wilson, the 14 points, the peacemakers at the end of the First World War, think that they've fastened upon some new way of doing things, and they're forgetting the lessons of the past, including biographers and historians of Castlereagh and Canning, and they make precisely that point. They could see that in 1919, that Castlereagh had the foresight, among others, because the Tsar at one point would have burned down Paris, just like the French burned down much of Russia before the winter got them. So he basically holds everyone back and says, no, we're not going to dismember France. You could go back to its borders from 1793. It can keep its colonies that Britain seized. He can give it back. So he does have that foresight. Absolutely, I think that's a pretty critical thing. And again, in 1945, people look at 1815 and not 1918.
The thing that caused problems is that he made them return the stolen art. And so that was the crucial thing. When Napoleon came back after Waterloo, he did take the decision that the French had to return all the art they'd stolen from around Europe. And so when he and Wellington went to the opera in Paris, they were hissed. This was the most serious thing they could have done. Forget the money. Why on earth are they making us return this art? So that was the dodgy moment.
Very good. Thank you very much, Richard, for that. Anybody else got a quick burning? Yes, the gentleman in a green shirt there. Just we'll get you a microphone. There we go. Thank you, Carolan.
I think I'm right in saying that he was behind, Castlereagh's behind or instrumental with the Peterloo massacre. If so, what sort of impact do you think that had on the public's opinion?
So the Peterloo Massacre of 1819 is a response in near Manchester to a public protest demand for better working rights, parliamentary reform, you know, kind of an early, I guess, socialist left-wing protest, if you use modern terms. Castlereagh was Foreign Secretary then. He was the leader of the government in the House of Commons because the Prime Minister sat in the House of Lords. So he bore the brunt for explaining what happened at Peterloo. So what happens at Peterloo is that protesters are shot down and cut down by the yeomanry. But actually, he bore no personal responsibility for it at all. And he becomes the lightning conductor again for dissent or irritation at the government. I mean, he's actually pretty despairing about it. But his job is to stand up and explain why government yeomanry, you know, chopped down and killed protesters in this scene. So it's another, you know, there's certain notches in Castlereagh's unpopularity that, you know, makes sense and are unjustifiable. It's just bad luck that he was, you know, the government spokesman essentially over Peterloo. He didn't, you know, personally bear any responsibility at all.
Thank you. Anybody else? Doesn't have to be, but if anybody has a quick thought, now's your chance. Okay, we'll take a last one from lady in the front. Thank you.
Just one small question, really. Did they have any children? Because syphilis, of course, had an impact on further generations.
Brilliant question. They didn't have any children, and it another thing that made them very close, Castlereagh and his wife Emily, that's part of the sort of affection attachment between the two, but absolutely bore deep in their heart, and you can see it in their letters and their you know, their love letters from their early years right through, this sort of closeness. They didn't have any children, which of course was one of the things that Byron and Shelley picked up upon. They said this smooth faced eunuch is one of the things they said about him, and it led to the imputation that then therefore he was gay and impotent and a sapless twig, another opponent described him as. So it's another thing that's sort of just bearing down upon his shoulders and feeds into this sort of soulfulness and melancholy that always surrounds Castlereagh.
They did have a kangaroo. That's a very important point. No, it's a very important point. They did have a kangaroo. The house in Kent, they had a sort of little zoo, didn't they? They collected animals from around the world. They had a tiger, a kangaroo. Do you know what else they had?
Classic Lady Castlereagh. Yeah, I mean, she had everything from around the world. You know, flamingos, a tiger, a kangaroo. And Castlereagh would bring, you know, these diplomats over. You know, the American ambassador, Richard Rush, would arrive at the house and describe these beautiful grounds and then hear this tiger roar and go and say, you know, what's going on here? It's sort of this Lady Castlereagh had a similar taste to a Chechen warlord, I would say, in that respect.
Yeah. So today we collect beer mats, then they collected exotic animals. I'm just going to let you in, as we bring things to a close, to the conversation we had earlier. And it's a final question, really, which is, should he be reappraised? Should we be more knowledgeable? People in this room are knowledgeable. If you weren't before you came into the room, I hope that you feel a lot more knowledgeable now leaving the room. But the point is, I'm not sure how well known Castlereagh is among the broad populace. And Ed was asking John and myself, how well known is Castlereagh in this part of the world? How would people think of Castlereagh if they heard that name? And I said, if they heard the word Castlereagh, they would say council. John said, holding centre. and I think that's very telling. You know, we maybe have forgotten too much about Castlereagh. Is that fair?
Actually, there's yes and no. We've forgotten aspects of the sort of Castlereagh diplomacy. He had this period of bad reputation. You know, compared to a Churchill, of course. You know, Churchill sort of dominates our understanding of 20th century British history. I guess Gladstone and Disraeli were the two dominant figures of the 19th. But actually, Castlereagh does matter and is appreciated by very important people, like, for example, Henry Kissinger. There are plenty of people. Two of our last three foreign secretaries have been historians who are aware of aspects of this story. So, you know, I think that historical appreciation is there. I would just make a plea to keep it alive and keep thinking about these things. I'd also say, you know, while Castlereagh should be rehabilitated and shouldn't be sneered at in the way he was sneered at, there's no point in sort of, you know, dusting over the ugly aspects of this story. As I say, 30,000 people die in 1798. Castlereagh locks up former friends and allies. He uses the Secret Service. He would make Edward Snowden blush for, you know, some of the things that were going on. I say there's wars, there's disastrous interventions as part of the Napoleonic Wars. There's the Peterloo Massacre that the gentleman, recognized again. So let's not gild the lily here, but let's be historically honest about what happened, but also, you know, appreciate how difficult the situation was in which he operated.
I mean, it's interesting. He's being remembered on his front lawn, in a sense, by what's happening today and what's happening this weekend. But beyond that, there's a bit of a gap between here and Henry Kissinger's front lawn, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. There is. I think so. One of the reasons we did the book about foreign secretaries as we did it is that it's very rare to find foreign secretaries who aren't deeply moral. They're trying to do the right thing as they see it. And one of the points, I think, to the extent that he should be really popularly remembered, it should be that he was trying, as were all of his peers and contemporaries, to do what was the right thing by the lights of their own reason. It's very rare to find someone who the stereotype of a politician who doesn't care applies to. It's not true. They all worked unbelievably hard. They didn't always get it right, but they did work incredibly hard. And I think it's just a different way of thinking about the people who took on that role and the work that they did.
Okay, well, it's been fascinating to hear your thoughts. Great opportunity to see extracts from the film again. Maybe it's time for Mark Adair to put pressure on the powers that be on the sixth floor to get it on BBC One or BBC Two Northern Ireland, because it's just it's very refreshing. And of course, all of the publications on the table are available in all good bookshops, as they say. Thank you very much for being such an attentive audience. I hope you enjoy the rest of today and the rest of tomorrow if you're here. But particularly, I want to say a word of thanks to Ed. I know you're sticking around today and tomorrow as well. Yeah. And John, lovely to see you home. That's been a fascinating start to a weekend of conversation. So thank you both very much.
Thank
indeed.
You, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.